It is Wednesday, December the 18th, 2013. I am Steve Growick, the webmaster of www.gerweck.net. Growick.net, your source on the World Wide Web since 1997 for all your pro wrestling news, results, rosters, polls. And since 1997, we've been following this particular character. He was in WCW, went independent after that as a personal trainer. And I've been a big fan of this guy. I thought he had a great look, great character in WCW. Obviously, the novelty act with Lenny Lane. And today, it's a very pleasure to welcome to Gerweck.net, Lodi. How you doing today, Lodi?
Hey, man, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. I guess the first question would be, a lot of people have not seen you in the limelight in a while. We've not seen you, obviously, with WCW, WWF, WWE, TNA. What have you been up to, say, in recent years, away from the limelight of the television?
You know, my last time on anybody's TV was 2002, so you're looking at 11, going 12 years ago since I've been on TV. And I did a pay-per-view with World Wrestling All-Stars back in 2002, and that was in February, I think, out in Vegas, maybe. Lenny and I had a tag match. And 2 months later, I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was helping run the syndicated radio guys. John Boy and Billy had a wrestling company we put out called Wrestle Force America, and I moved here from Atlanta to help run that for them, and left working for Dusty Rhodes down in Atlanta, and I came to Charlotte and broke my neck. So it was the second time I went under the knife for a ruptured disc in my neck, and I missed about 18 months, and really after having that surgery twice, thought my wrestling career was over, and it pretty much put aside ever wrestling again. And 18 months goes by, and you know, it was something that I had done for a long time and always loved, obviously. And some kids asked me about helping train them and do some, just learning some technical wrestling, not taking any bumps or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I really can't do that. I had a broken neck and kind of done with wrestling. And one day, man, I'm walking by my bed and I'm like, I wonder if I could take a bump. And I just kind of fell back on my bed and I was like, hey, that didn't feel too bad. And 2 weeks later, I was in a wrestling ring, and I started doing independent shows again, and here we are in 2013, and I'm working every weekend still. So kind of crazy how time fast-forwards and flies, but yeah, still doing it, working.
Got the juices flowing again, and there you are back in the ring again.
Yeah.
I guess, how are you doing physically now? As you said, you've been in the business for many of years, and you've taken a lot of bumps,
yeah,
a lot of injuries. How you doing?
18 years, man, and it kind of seems like it's been a blink of an eye in a lot of ways, and injuries, you know, I've had 2 knee surgeries, I've had 2 ankle surgeries, you know, I mentioned the neck, I had my first neck surgery before I ever got into wrestling. I got hurt as a competitive bodybuilder, well, I was a competitive bodybuilder, I got hurt in the gym, trying to be a crazy meathead and lift a lot of weight, but, so I had one serious neck injury before I ever started wrestling, but, you know, beaten up, banged up, lots of concussions and issues along the way, typical of an 18-year career, but, you know, the last 2 or 3 years, probably in the best physical shape I've been in my entire life. And part of that over a year ago, and I've got to put a plug in for my buddy DDP here, but just like so many of the people that you've heard and some of the wrestlers, you know, got into doing some DDP yoga. And I'm telling you, it's really taken me back. I think my body in age wise, because I feel better physically right now than I have in years. And the last 2 years, I've actually worked more shows in any year I have since I've been off TV. So I'm working more and I feel better. And I give a lot of credit to that page for creating such an awesome workout with his DDP yoga DVDs and all that stuff. And I could talk about it for an hour and I still don't think I could explain it to the point of where people would get it. So it's that cool. It's that great. And it's helped me immensely. So physically the body's doing pretty well.
I want to ask you about the training. I know you trained with, C.W. Anderson, who, of course, was in ECW and, of course, in WWF as well. And then you went on to the Power Plant. And I heard in an interview you were talking that you just got beat up by C.W. and then you got beat up at the Power Plant.
Yeah.
How different was the training? Obviously, WCW was more – the Power Plant was more structured.
Right.
And you had different trainers. You had Pez and you had the Sarge. Just in general, how did the training differ between the two?
You know, the greatest thing about breaking into the business, and I'm going to sound like one of those old grizzly veterans now, but, you know, in 1995, I was introduced to C.W. Anderson through an acquaintance we both had who had walked into my gym. Actually, I was a personal trainer, had a studio, I graduated from East Carolina University, and had my own personal training business, and a guy walked in one day and wanted me to sponsor a local wrestling show. And being a wrestling fan growing up in the Carolinas, growing up watching Mid-Atlantic Wrestling and watching NWA and Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes and that whole nine yards and just loving that. He said, man, you know, you're a pretty big guy. You're in good shape. Would you be interested in ever wrestling? And I had actually a roommate in college who was an independent wrestler who had talked to me about it some then, but I was putting myself through college. I didn't have the time to train or anything like that at the point. But at this place in my life, I said, you know, sure. And he said, man, my trainer was C.W. Anderson. Maybe he could train you and you could help him get in better shape in the gym. Maybe you guys could talk and see what transpires. And so he ran a wrestling school up out in Smithfield, North Carolina, outside of Raleigh. And I was down in Greenville, so it was an hour and a half drive. And he trained on Tuesday and Thursday nights to get there, hour and a half there, hour and a half back. And I went for 2 weeks, and I guess I went back from my training session. And CW looks at me, and he said, man, he said, you're going to keep coming back, aren't you? And I said, well, yeah, why? And he said, well, you know, now I guess I can start teaching you how to wrestle. I'm like, well, what have you been doing for 2 weeks? And literally looking at me, he said, now she's been beating you up for 2 weeks to see if you'd quit. And so I was like, wow, you mean it's going to get easier? Because literally for four sessions, he just beat me up for a couple of hours a night. And I didn't know any better because I didn't know what the business was like or how it worked. And so it was a good way to kind of weed some people out, I think, initially. And CW was a great trainer, and he was very patient with me. And I saw him be incredibly patient with some other guys that came through his little training center. And he's turned out some really quality guys over the years, some guys who have great respect for the business. And I thank CW for so many things. I got me, you know, I had my first match about 2.5-3 months after I started training. And about a year and a half into my training, I moved down to Atlanta, went to the power plant like you talked about. And so down there, it's a whole nother, you know, step up to be trained over again. But going down there and having a year and a half behind me of wrestling shows and a good trainer like CW, I was a little further ahead of the curve, I think, than most guys who were just starting out the power plant and never been trained. But I'd learned how to work to a degree. I'm not saying I was super great. I'm still what I would consider at this point in my life, now looking back, really green. But you got in the ring with Mike Winter, who's one of the trainers who taught you some of the finer technical stuff of, you know, just wrestling and some whatever, but really had a real light style. And you kind of graduated from working with Mike to working with Sarge, Buddy Lee Parker. And he was stiff to the point of where, I mean, he would never hurt you to the point where you had to go to the hospital. He was safe with what he was doing, but you talk about stiff. The man would kick and beat and forearm you to death, and it was just a whole different kind of a game changer from working with somebody who's really light as opposed to working for somebody who lays everything in. Two entirely different styles. And then, of course, you mentioned his name either the late and great Pez Watley, who I looked up to as a kid, who also helped us with our psychology to have the power plant, and somebody I owe a lot to for the rest of my life. Again, he taught me so many things about working with a crowd and how to get people to care about you and your character, whether it's good or bad, that you've got to get a reaction from that crowd. And that's some of the stuff that Pez taught me that, you know, nobody else at that point in my career, it had the grasp on that he did and worked in front of those crowds and to really explain it to me where I could get it. And so for all my trainers down at the power plant, I was in a debt of gratitude. But then also the people that came through the power plant to just practice and train, they were already at WCW, but down in Atlanta, again, like DDP, you know, to have Paige come in the ring and work with us young kids. And, you know, Goldberg was trained down at the time, to have Terry Taylor drop in, you know, every couple of weeks and help you just – I was surrounded by some of the guys who have been the best in this business and had been really good at it at a young age. And then, you know, 2 years from the time I took my first bump, I started at WCW. So a real quick transaction from working in front of 50 people in an armory in North Carolina to my first night with WCW was on a pay-per-view at Auburn Hills in Michigan. And, you know, I've got 18,000 people on a pay-per-view. And so surrounded by some of the best in the business at that time, I was really blessed to be around some great guys who offered me some of their knowledge and helped me grow and mature as a wrestler.
What did you learn specifically that you could transition to be a trainer yourself? You've helped people train for the ring. And in fact, we just had one of your students, Darcy Dixon, on here.
Right.
And had a chance to meet her. And I think she's doing really well.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the kids that you've helped train and, Darcy herself?
Yeah. You know, Darcy's been, you know, she's great in the ring, athletic. And here's the thing. she had a heart for the business. You know, when she started training with me, she went out of her way to as many days a week as she could make it down to the training. So we train high spots here in Charlotte on my lunch break from the gym. I have a personal training studio here, and so 12 to 4 is kind of the bedtime for most personal trainers. And so, you know, along the way, I've ran across several guys I've helped earlier in their career, like one of my old tag team partners I've just recently reacquainted with and started working again, not say reacquainted, and wrestling in the ring with, Scotty Matthews. I met him when he was a young kid and kind of turned him on to CW, sent him to get trained by CW, and there were some other guys along the way that I helped out. And more recently, like you mentioned last year, I had Darcy Dixon, another one of my students I'm pretty proud of that I started, you know, from scratch, was William the Hammer Roberts, another indie guy here in North Carolina that was on the track team at Appalachian here in North Carolina. And before she went down to NXT, I started with Ashley Flair. And Ashley just absolutely, you know, athletically gifted beyond, you know, most people's wildest aspirations. And she's going to be a big star one day. I can't say enough great things about her. She worked hard too. But all three of those kids really went out of their way to do as much as they could, especially in the beginning, to get to practice as much as possible and learn, just soak up things like a sponge, you know. So I'm real proud of all three of them.
Can you talk about, once you got to WCW, what was the management style? And did you have any input into your character or the storylines that you were portraying on television?
You know, I was a different case or a different bird than most, and I use the word bird in reference to Raven, because I was at the power plant and actually done a couple of matches for the WCW Pro Show down in Orlando, which we taped every 4 months. We'd go down to 3 months of that Saturday morning show called the WCW Pro. But basically, it was all the stars working with some enhancement guys. We'd do 3 months of TV at a time, put that in the tank. So I'd been down there and done that from just being at the power plant. But most people know this story behind the scenes. I had met Raven early when I moved down to Atlanta. He first came to WCW. And he hired me as his personal trainer, which quickly transitioned into me being his personal assistant. And so we were, you know, I was doing a lot of errands for him while he was on the road, things he couldn't get to, being, you know, tied up with a travel schedule or whatever. And with my independent booking and wrestling schedule, we were missing each other a lot. So he'd be home on some weekends, and I would be off wrestling. I was home during the week, and he'd be off wrestling. And came to a point when Stevie Richards was leaving WCW, and he was like, you know, this is Raven talking to me. He's like, I'm so tired of you not being here when I'm here, so I need to take you on the road with me. And I'm like, hey, that'd be great. And I'll never forget, we were sitting in a bar at 11:30 or 12 o'clock on a Thursday night, and he called Terry Taylor, who's, you know, one of the bookers at the time at WCW, and he called him, and Terry could barely hear him because we're inside a bar. And he said, you know, is it possible for me to put Brad Kane from down at the power plant in the flock on Monday at Nitro? And lost connection, whatever, we had to step outside, and Raven called Terry back, and he's like, well, why don't you put him in the, you know, flock on Sunday at the pay-per-view? Well, this is Thursday night at, you know, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and to be at the pay-per-view, I had to fly out Saturday morning, and he said, sure, we'll bring in the pay-per-view. So I had basically a little over 24 hours to go from a dark-headed kid to the Billy Idol look-alike you saw up here, you know, Auburn Hills in Michigan, 2 days later with some black pants and some chains and a glove. So it was a quick transition from the person I looked like to making Lodi happen on that first Sunday night. But a kind of a dream come true, and it's one of those things where you talk about, you know, the management style, because I was in part of Raven's flock, and Raven had somewhat creative control over his character and his group, you know, basically, as opposed to dealing with being told by management what to do. Raven kind of had free reign with his guys, and it was really cool that he could give us all characters and kind of dictate what we were going to do and where our characters were headed. So I was dealt with a little bit differently as opposed to somebody who was just a standalone character coming in on his own, if that makes sense. And so, you know, the first year and a half or so I was at WCW, most of it was under the direction of Raven. And, you know, like my matches and stuff, of course, went through Terry Taylor and those guys. They booked the matches, but a lot of what I did go back to what Raven wanted my character to do, because I was part of his act.
I think you were alluding to it. Raven had creative control, and I think that was probably the problem with WCW at that time. Other individuals had their own creative control, and it didn't seem like anybody was really running the company, because I can't do this because this guy's got creative control, and I can't do this. This guy has creative control. So kind of looking back, was that a common criticism that you saw, and then did you see the writing on the wall at that time, because, you know, obviously you can't have 10 guys running the ship. You need a captain to run the ship. And then you didn't have that at WWE.
Right. Well, and that's what I have alluded to many times later on, as WCW started to have issues. When I said creative control, Raven had what I feel like is creative control over his character, what type of character he portrayed. Didn't necessarily have creative control when it came to who am I working with this weekend and am I doing the job or is he putting me over. I think some of the upper echelon guys, not the mid-card guys, but the upper echelon guys who, when they had creative control of their character and could really dictate who they were going to work with and who they were going to put over or not put over, I think that's where all the problems started from up top, and it started coming down. Because if you're a booker of a company, let's just say, for instance, your name's Terry Taylor, and you happen to book this mythical company, WCW, and you draw out this whole show of, let's say, you know, 3 hours of TV, and you get there on Monday, and half the guys say, I'm not doing that, and they can, and you have to rewrite everything, sooner or later, that's going to go sideways. And so when I was mentioning Raven had creative control, him not having creative control so much as where he could dictate whether he won or lost or what he was going to do, more so what his character was going to look like, what his promos were going to be about, where was his character and his group coming from, if that makes sense. So it was more of the upper echelon guys, when it gets into creative control, had that kind of creative control in charge of, yeah, I'm not working with so-and-so, and yeah, I'm not putting so-and-so over, where you got too many Indians and not enough chiefs. Wait a minute, it was the other way around. Too many chiefs and not enough Indians.
Was it chaotic? You're talking about, you know, you book the show and then you get to TV on Monday and somebody's saying, hey, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing... Was it really chaotic backstage?
My favorite story of all time when it comes to chaos and seeing the writing on the wall. When I first started WCW, when we have Nitro on Mondays, we had to be at the building at 2 o'clock. We walk in at 2 o'clock, go to catering. There's a big board up. This is who's working with who. Boom, the whole show. 3 hours on TV or whatever. Boom, right there. That's up at 2 o'clock. As time goes on, you know, the board's not up until 4 o'clock. As time goes on, the board's not up until 5:30 or 6 o'clock. Time goes on, it's even getting later. Now, we go live at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I will never forget, I don't remember where we were, but I'll never forget the scene. WCW, we gotten really bad about, instead of just flying in the guys that were going to work the show, they were flying in more guys. So if we needed 50 guys for a three-hour show, there'd probably be 100 guys there because they didn't know who they were going to use until the last minute.
Wow.
So that's a waste of money, obviously. But I will never forget, it's like 7:30 or 7:45, and there's no board up. And the guys are just sitting around, and the guys who like were being flown in and not being used a lot, they were used to getting there, saying, hey, my name's on the board, I'm catching a flight back home, I'm out of here. So we're sitting there 7:30, 7:45, and the locker room is packed because nobody's left. And Arne Anderson comes in, you know, one of our booking agents. He goes, all right, it's 7:45. I don't know who's working with who. Everybody get dressed. You know, and I'm like thinking to myself, I'm like, we're a multi-million-dollar company, and we're going live to TV in 15 minutes, and we don't know who the first match is? Are you kidding me? But, you know, when you see that, then all of a sudden it's like, man, this shit's gotten out of control.
So I guess with the end of WCW, I assume you weren't surprised to see the ship ultimately sink.
No, not at all. I mean, I didn't make it to the very end. I got let go just several months before the company was sold. And, you know, that was one of the things. Lenny and I were trying to get out of our contract. We were begging J.J. Dillon to let us out of our contract. And every single time we asked, no, you guys are great. You're the future of this company. We want to keep you around. This is after we've been taken off TV, et cetera, whatever, and we're begging. And they wouldn't let us out of our contracts. And, you know, because then people started getting fired, and the number got smaller, and we're still there. And so the guys who got let go first all got jobs with Vince in the beginning, and then the company got bought. But, you know, no, it wasn't a surprise because it just became such a cluster there at the end. It was like, you know, for something that had been around so long, and something for me being an NWA fan, watching that transcend over to WCW, and just something that you thought would be like Ford and Chevy be around forever, you're like, this sucker's not going to make it.
<laughs> You know? Now, when you were requesting your release, you and Lenny, did you have some, obviously you were under contract, but you couldn't really talk to WWF, or, you know, would have been WWF at that time, but
we couldn't talk. I'm doing that in air quotes right now on the phone.
Right. But not officially.
We couldn't talk.
There were some feelers out there to see maybe there was some interest.
I had a certain friend of mine that grew up in North Carolina and started with all of us in our little North Carolina group who said, hey, if you can get out of your contract, so-and-so has told me you guys have a job here. And so we were begging out of our contract. What happened? And also, at that point, Raven had left WCW and go back to ECW and had the same guarantee from Paul Heyman. If you guys can get out of your contract, we'll put you on TV next week.
So what ultimately happened? Because we never did see you in WWF.
No, never. And remember, okay, so then right after the company was bought, I had been let go, and then TNA was coming about. And Lenny and I actually signed the first contracts with TNA, but that was 2002. I had just broken my neck, and I was never cleared, and I was never cleared to wrestle. So that's when that whole thing took place. I actually have a signed four-show contract deal with Jeff Jarrett from the very beginning with TNA that I was never able to fulfill because of my neck injury.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Talk about the tag team Lenny and Lodi, because obviously at that time it was one of the most controversial tag teams. Obviously you're portraying, even though I don't think it was meant to be, a gay characters. How did you feel about that character, doing that type of gimmick, that type of tag team, and whose brainchild was that?
You know, if you follow the storyline from beginning to end, we were brothers. All we were affectionate to each other. The storyline was 110% Lenny Lane. And he ran it by me. Here's the lowdown on that. Oh, from Lodi himself. The flock had been set free. The whole flock angle was over. And instead of being on Nitro and Thunder and every single pay-per-view, all of a sudden Lodi's on his own. And you take a guy who's a flunky character in a bad guy group in the bottom of that totem pole, how you turn that around and make him a superstar? That's a hard transition. And so the company had so many guys, I was kind of relegated to doing Saturday night shows. And Terry Taylor didn't come up with this gimmick with me where I was doing a loaded glove thing on Saturday night where I was putting a gimmick in my glove at the end, knocking guys out. But there wasn't a whole lot of direction for my character at that point. And Lenny Lane, who was also an enhancement guy, who you saw on Saturday night and occasionally on Nitro or Thunder, came up to me at a Saturday night taping and said, hey, Lodi, what are they doing with your character? I said, not a whole lot. And he goes, hey, bro, what about you and I become a tag team? And I will never forget looking at him. I'm like, what are we going to be? Lenny and Lodi the losers? Are you kidding me? do we need another jobber tag team here at WCW? He goes, well, yeah, I mean, that's not a cool gimmick. But he said, what about this? And he said, what if we kind of portrayed something along the lines of the Saturday Night Live get the ambiguously gay duo? Something where, you know, like, for instance, his idea was, we'll do a vignette where we're walking down the beach and we're eating ice cream and my ice cream falls and you're like, hey, Lenny, I'll share with you and you give me your ice cream cone. And I'm like, bro, that just sounds horrific. I said, tell you what, he's looking at the time, and Kevin had always been super nice to me. And we had a good relationship. And I said, do me this favor. I said, I'll see 2 weeks at TV. We were taping because every Saturday night, every other week. I said, write it all out and bring it to me, and I'll take it to Kevin. And I legitimately thought I'd never hear anything else out of it. I set up 2 weeks later for TV. Lenny shows up in like this four-page type outline of this whole Lenny and Lodi tag team deal. And I'm like, you did it. He's like, well, you asked me to. And I'm like, all right. And so I said, I'll take it to Kevin. And now Lenny wasn't the most prolific writer. And the first line of this whole outline was this. This is not a gay gimmick. That's how it started. And I read the first line. I'm like, oh, this is never going to fly. But I promised him I would take it to Kevin Nash. So I go in the booking office. I'm like, Kevin, I'll talk to you for a second. He's like, sure, Lo, what's up? I'm like, hey, man, can I give you this idea for me and Lenny to do a tag team? And he reads that this is not a gay gimmick. And he just looked at me like, you know, I had three heads. And I'm like, just look it over. He goes, bro, we can't do this here. And I'm like, okay. And that was it. You know, and I went back home. And about a month and a half later, I got a phone call from a good friend of mine who was the former editor of the WCW magazine, Ross Foreman, who was good friends with Kevin Nash. And I was living in L.A. at the time. And he said, Lodi, I got to tell you something. And I'm like, what? He goes, keep this secret. You can hear from me. You're going to get a call in a few minutes. They're going to do the Lenny and Lodi thing. I'm like, what? I mean, this was one of the most shocking phone calls of my entire life. He goes, I can't talk about it. Be surprised when you get the call later. And he hung up on me. And it was probably 30 minutes when I got a call from Kevin. He said, hey, bro, can you get Nitro Monday? I'm like, sure. He said, all right, I'll see you there. And that's where it came from. And honestly, one of the most enjoyable times of my entire wrestling career. Lenny and I had so, and up to that point, I knew Lenny by name. Hey, Lenny, how are you? He knew me by name. We'd never spent time together. We'd never ridden in a car together, much less shared a hotel, much less been a tag team. And it was one of those magical things in wrestling that you somebody who's just random, that you guys get together and start working together, and literally it just worked. And the chemistry we had in the ring, I don't know that I've had that with anybody else in my entire life, as far as just the way we were able to play off each other and feed off each other and just make everything gel like it did. And in real life, I think he and I, obviously because we're working together every single night, you know, we're riding together, sharing cars and sharing hotel rooms and doing everything together, I think that came out on screen. And I still consider him one of the best people I've ever spent time with in my life. We just got along so well. It was awesome.
I think that was a very memorable tag team. Angie from Twitter wants to know, what was it like in working with Stacy Keibler?
Stacy was very young when Lenny and I got kicked off TV, you know, because of a protest from Glad and that whole nine yards. And, you know, that was well covered in all the magazines and newspapers and stuff, whatever. When they brought us back, they thought it would be good to stick a girl with us and give us a different, you know, image and different idea and different characters. And at that point, Stacy had never done anything wrestling related, and her wrestling knowledge was very, very limited. And Lenny and I both agreed, and I think I probably pushed for this more than even he did, was to get rid of her as far as being tied in with us, because they were really, some of the guys at WWE that were in charge, some of the bookers were really pushing her character more so than they were pushing us. And we all know where, you know, what she's done and the heights she's gone to with her acting career and her time with Vince, and very beautiful woman. And just, like I said, at that point, very young, and like literally was set to be involved in her matches, and on several occasions made some really big wrestling bonehead mistakes, like coming out too early, coming out too late, those kind of things. So she just didn't have the wrestling knowledge at the time to pull off what she needed to do. And so we really wanted to get away from her. And Kevin Sullivan let us do that at one point. We actually had this little, you know, we did a little vignette on TV where, you know, we got rid of her and went back into our cool party outfits or whatever. But literally that was almost like a shoot in real life. And again, just she wasn't at the point where she needed to be, I felt like, to help us. I thought it was more of a hindrance at the time.
What was the biggest highlight? What's like the most memorable thing when you think back at your WCW experience? What kind of sticks out as like, this was the highlight, this was the best?
You know, everybody asks what's my favorite match. And the one thing for me that is such an electric moment, and you go back to me training my wrestling kids, and something I always make them watch. My favorite, because of the culmination of the ongoing storyline, the night at Fall Brawl in 1998 when Raven had to wrestle Saturn. If Raven won, Saturn had to stay in the flock. If Saturn won, he set the flock free. It took place in Winston-Salem, close to my hometown. I'm here again from North Carolina. It had so much of my family and friends there. And, you know, Canyon was involved in the match, and the whole flock was involved in the match. And the way Raven and Saturn at Fall Brawl 98, if you've never seen it, it's worth going and pulling back up on YouTube or Bing or wherever you can find it, just for all the false finishes and the storyline and the way that crowd reacted to every single false finish, with just this loud, thunderous, I mean, almost over-the-top boisterous response. And it's just, that's when you got people, you know, they're emotionally invested, and you were getting a response from everything we did in that match. And, you know, that Saturn, you know, he gave me the Death Valley driver at the table on the outside at the end. And it just, that match to me, because it was a culmination of such a big storyline that I've been involved with for so long, that was really a highlight. You know, Lenny winning the Cruiserweight belt over Rey Mysterio down in Lubbock, Texas, that stands out as a highlight because it was a cool thing for us. And you know, but everything that happened, you know, the entire thing we got to do at WCW, all the places we got to go and the travel and the, you know, but as far as the two matches, those are two that stand out, but there are so many that just, not to ramble on all day about the great experiences I got to have, but those two are probably two of the biggest highlights for, as far as like in-ring work and matches.
I guess this probably isn't asked very often, but what would be the low light? What was kind of the bottom when you were there at WCW? What, when they have nothing for you, you're sitting at home. That's obviously, that's pretty
frustrating. That was frustrating, but I was getting paid. You know,
right.
The hardest thing was when WCW didn't stand by our characters when Vlad protested, and we had to stay home for 6 months. We got paid every 2 weeks like we're supposed to, and the company wouldn't let us go because they kept trying to come up with new gimmicks to let us back on TV, and the Standards and Practices group kept shooting it down, and you know, ultimately it put us back on TV as Standards and Practices, which I hated, and Lenny hated, and, you know, we had a lot of untruths given to us by Vince Russo and Vince Ron, what they were going to do with our characters when they came back, that, you know, we were promised six or seven things our first night back, and within a week, all six or seven things we were promised were broken, and it just created a lot of distrust there, and a lot of angst that I've let go at this point. And there were some early interviews I did that I really trashed Vince Russo and Ferraro for what they did and what they told us and how ultimately it was, none of it was true what they were telling us. And so we felt misled, but you know, it's the nature of the beast. And I've forgiven all that now and I'm past it. But the low point was when Vlad protested and had their four or five bullet points why they didn't think our characters should be on TV and why WCW stepped away from, you know, and immediately took us off. Every bullet point that Vlad put out there that we had broken or done wrong were all false. None of them were true. And instead of WCW standing up to them, they kind of caved in the special interest group immediately and sat us at home. And I think that was kind of, you know, the death knell for my and Lenny's career from there with the timing and everything else. And it was hard to go from we were scheduled the next pay-per-view to actually work with Harlem Heat for the Tag Team Championships. And got sent home a couple of weeks early for that, and you know, obviously never got back to that level. So that was a little frustrating, you know, to be so close to something that would have been so big for our career, you know, from not only just our wrestling personas, but something as a kid growing up loving wrestling and being almost at the pinnacle of being a world tag team champion for WCW. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's kind of a big deal for two guys our size and with our work rate and ability and where we've been, you know, at that point in our career. So. That was probably the lowest point, was sitting home and just being taken off TV for really what was no fault of our own, maybe being too good at what we did because we got too much attention.
Gary from Twitter wants to know, actually a two-part question. One, your opinion on Eric Bischoff, and number two, did you ever meet Ted Turner?
Second answer quick, never met Ted Turner, although his name was stamped on every check I got every other week, which was kind of cool.
That's always good.
That was always cool. Good. You know, that one's not going to bounce. That's always
right.
A good check. Unlike some of my buddies at ECW, just saying.
True.
That was a difference.
Right.
Eric Bischoff, when I got to World Championship Wrestling and started, he was pretty much dealing with the really high upper echelon guys. You know, and didn't have a lot of one-on-one interaction with him. He had some interaction with me and Lenny over the West Hollywood Blonde thing, to the point of where, like, again, go back to, we were doing our character so well, his comment to us was like, okay, guys, you need to tone that down just a little bit. You can't, like, go that far with it. So we're like, okay, we got it. But as far as he and I sitting down and having a 15-minute conversation one-on-one, Never happened.
What's your thoughts on NWO? Because obviously NWO is what really brought a lot of fans to WCW. And
yeah.
Of course you came in after it started, but
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of criticism that, you know, what really kind of killed WCW's momentum is they just continued to NWO angle and then they watered it down with subgroups of NWO. You know, kind of looking back, did you ever want to be a part of that group? And is that a fair criticism that they just didn't kind of an end game to the NWO?
Well, you know, it is a fair criticism, and you took some of the words out of my mouth that I would say caused the issues there with, you know, the subgroups, you know, the red and black, and all of a sudden, right. You know, NWO being kind of an elite group of guys, so all of a sudden, you know, you got 27 guys out there, like, really?
Yeah.
NWO? And, you know, I think your idea of maybe spinning it off to a whole other deal, you know, may have worked, and kind of like I said, it kind of got watered down, and I don't know what their original plans were in the beginning. Like I said, I wasn't involved in the upper echelon ideas or that kind of stuff. And, you know, I love Kevin Nash and Scott Hall. I've used this comment over and over again. I'll say it again. It's, obviously, you can't watch just one wrestler work for the rest of your life and cut promos, but at the height of his career, if there was one guy that I love watching more than anybody else, it's always been Scott Hall. He entertained me. He was a great guy to me. I got along well with him. We traveled together several times, and I think the world of him and his work. And so those guys, I was a big fan of them. And, you know, we always joked that we thought it would have been a great angle before the NWO got so watered down. The NWO versus the Flock. You know, that was kind of what we were all pulling.
Right.
That's what, kind of what we were all pulling for. But, you know, the Flock had some heat and some momentum with the fans. And you could ask the other Flock mates if you get them on your show, but a lot of them attribute us being killed off due to the fact that the NWO was starting to feel a little heat from this other bad guy group. And there was this long blonde-haired guy that had dark sideburns and dark facial hair and maybe 24-inch arms that didn't like having two bad guy groups running around, you know. So the end was cut, again, with the whole Flock angle, a little short due to, I think we're getting over a little too much for some people's liking.
I want to ask you about Chris Benoit. Obviously, you worked with him. You had some great matches with him. He said, I heard an interview, you said that he helped you, you know, when you were starting out. Can you kind of talk about working with Chris and then obviously the tragedy? What was going through your mind when, you know, you got the call or you heard that what had happened with Chris Benoit?
Chris Benoit was one of the most professional wrestlers I ever had the opportunity to work with. He was the best at what he did. He was phenomenal. And as a fan, you might can watch it. You can hear it 100 times, but until you get in the ring and actually have the chance to work with him and know how good he was and what he did, he was just, I can, again, it's the only thing I could talk about for an hour and not do it justice. My first match ever on, you know, Nitro was against Chris Benoit. And I'll always hold a real fondness in my heart for the way he treated me. And the way, you know, when I came into the Flock, we were in a, and they were involved in a big angle with Benoit. So obviously that was my first angle at WCW. And it was so good after we broke off from our Flock battle with Benoit, we went back and did it again. There was a whole nother run of it just because it made for good TV and good stuff. And I think, again, that there was some chemistry there with him and Raven that the fans like to see and the physicality of their matches and the things he would do to make everything look so good. And when I got the phone call and I found out that what had happened, I was literally sick to my stomach. I to this day, I have a hard time believing. I mean, obviously, I don't doubt all the stories and what happened. I just, it's hard to imagine it. If somebody would have called me, I could have been more shocked if somebody would have called and told me my own brother had done that. And my own brother is probably the least vital person in the world. It was just that big a shock to me. And it was a very sad ending to what I thought was a really illustrious career. And just, you know, the fact that when he got to win the belt at WWE, it was just that was a moment for me to watch as a fan and a friend to be, you know, just so happy for him to see his career go to the heights it had gone to. And, you know, if you've never seen him work or missed a lot of his work, you know, his stuff in Japan and everything he did in the States, he was the best at what he did.
Did you ever see a dark side with him?
No, never.
No, okay.
No, I mean, and I've been with Chris when, you know, it's not this is new or news, but, you know, we had a tendency to be out of control at WCW with our party, and my drug abuse and use through all my years at WCW is well documented, not something I run from or hide from. And, you know, as far as, you know, drinking too much and partying too hard, I mean, that was everybody. And so as far as seeing a dark side of him, no, not me, no, never.
Now, I don't know if you've heard this kind of a side issue with Benoit is in recent weeks, you've heard that his son wants to get into professional wrestling. I guess if you could talk to him, what would you say? What advice could you give him?
I have not heard that yet. And if that's what he wants to do, you know, I never dissuade anybody from getting into the wrestling business. Obviously, I feel like I owe it a great deal because it has given me so much. I also know it owes nobody anything, and you get out of it what you put into it. And so it's a tough road. And I think, you know, we talked earlier about some of the kids I trained who I think have done phenomenal work in such a short amount of time. But I've also worked with a couple people who burn out really quick, as far as really never even had a first match, made through a couple of practices, or maybe even had one or two matches and realized it just wasn't for them. I think it's very easy to flip on Raw on Monday night, or, you know, watch SmackDown on Friday night, or, you know, even watch Impact and be like, oh, I want to do that. Oh, look at the people, you know, cheer for them. You don't see what goes into that. You don't see the hours on the road, and you don't see the time in the gym and all the effort that it takes to get to that point. And I think a lot of people think it's a quicker road to success than it is, and more people burn out than ever make it. And, you know, there are thousands of people vying for a very few amount of spots. And, right. You know, you talk about, you know, we mentioned earlier about all the indie shows and stuff I do now, you know, so many, you know, with air travel being a little tougher than it was pre-9/11, you know, for me, I drive, you know, I do a show, I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. I do a show in Pittsburgh once a month. I mean, that's a 7-hour drive up there and back. And so, you know, I've got kids I take with me that train with me and that I get booked on the shows up there, and they come from South Carolina a couple hours further. I mean, they're making a 9-hour trip up, wrestling, and turn around and driving 9 hours back, you know, for not a whole lot of money because they're still young kids trying to make it. So I think it's easy to see what happens on TV and you don't see the backside of it, of doing independent shows for 3 or 4 or maybe even 6, 7, 8 years before you get a chance to make it somewhere or go down to NXT and you know, train at WWE or, you know, maybe get a dark match or Impact or whatever. There's just, it's not snap my fingers, hey, I work out in the gym and I'm going to be on TV next week. It's a really long process. So my biggest thing is I love kids to have a college degree first because, hey, if you don't make it with wrestling, you got something to fall back on. You're never going to go hungry.
That's true. Do you receive royalty checks from WWE since they own all the footage?
No, nothing, because WCW, there's no longer a company. So, no, I don't receive any royalty checks from WWE.
Oh, that's a bummer. Gosh.
Yeah, you know, I got them up until the end, you know, because, you know, that was one of the cool things. You know, I always joke and tell people, they're like, you know, what was the coolest thing about, you know, when WCW came out and we're on video games, you know, and I'll never forget 1998, my first quarterly royalty check came in for being on 4 video games. And to be on a video game back then, literally they would take 4 shots of you, like a headshot straight on to the side and from the back, and you were done. You get a $36,000 royalty check for being on 4 video games for 1 quarter, and you're thinking, you're cooking with gas, man. You know, that's a pretty good deal.
Wow.
And, you know, so the royalty checks were nice while they came in, but once WCW was bought by WWE, then, yeah, they aren't paying the WCW guys anymore.
Now, another colleague wanted to know, why do you think your character is so memorable? I think about wrestling today, it seems like a lot of the wrestlers are more generic. They have names. They don't really have characters as much anymore. Do you kind of see that? And why do you think that your character is still so – people still talk about Lenny and Lodi, you know, going back to the day?
You know, I think part of this, and I'm dealing with this on a weekly basis now with my young kids that I'm training to wrestle. I feel like a lot of guys who spend time doing independent shows, again, the 50 – 100, 150 people that you may have at a show, you know, those people don't know you when you go out there. And if this is what I garnered and took away from Pez Watley as a really young wrestler, there are certain things you need to do to get those people to interact with you and to get into you and emotionally get invested in you. And whether it's you're showing a look of, you've got to go out there and portray that you are the character you're portraying. In other words, you believe what you're doing. I get on to so many of my young kids now because I watch them and they look like they're play wrestling. Again, there's my air quotes. It's like they're playing a wrestler. It's like, okay, tongue in cheek, wink, wink, crowd. I know I'm not a real wrestler. I'm faking my way through this. I'm not really a wrestler. And I think if you go out there and invest in yourself and you're a great actor and you make people buy into that character, there's a difference. I also think now you see so many guys come out of, you know, the young kids. Very rarely do you see the Wyatts have been a step away from that, but so many of the guys are kind of that cookie cutter mold. They all kind of look the same. They're all in great shape, and they don't really get into a character per se that separates them from anybody else. And it's almost, for instance, you know, there are a whole lot of collegiate wrestlers, but collegiate wrestling doesn't draw big number ratings on Saturday afternoons on TV if it's ever on, because you've got two guys rolling around wrestling. There's no story behind it, or there's nothing invested. And if you can't go out, and especially on these small indie shows, and be a really good babyface, the good guy, or be a really good villain, a bad guy, if you don't have the ability to portray that with your actions and the way you carry yourself, all the way into the way you wrestle in the ring, if you just go out there, you may be great at the moves, but if you just go to the ring against another guy and you guys just do wrestling moves, the fans don't care. They got to get invested. You got to be Rocky Balboa so they cheer for you, or you got to be Ivan Drago so they boo you. You've got to get a reaction. If you go out and you don't get a reaction, you can't blame that on the crowd. They paid to see professional wrestling. They came to boo and they came to cheer. And I think too many guys skip that part of it and go out and like, hey, let's do, you know, a four-star match. Why aren't they booing or why aren't they cheering? They don't care if you just do the wrestling moves. There's got to be a story there, and there's got to be a character that they can either get behind and cheer for, or a character they can get behind and love to hate.
I think you nailed it, because actually when I was talking to your student there, Darcy,
yeah,
I said, you know, if Vince calls you tomorrow and says, I want to bring you to television, now tell me what separates you from the other girls I have under contract. I don't know if people really, you know, people that want to get into the, I don't know if they really think about that. They just think, I'm going to train, I'm going to work real hard, then hopefully someday I'm going to be on television. I don't know if they understand that you have to develop a character, you have to develop facial expressions, you have to develop ability to talk, and sometimes when we see these guys on TV, they doesn't look like they've developed that.
You're right. And here's the thing. I think if you were, for instance, just went to the power plant and never did independent shows before there and they put you on TV, you go out and you wrestle. You leave out that part of getting that crowd to react to you. If you go out, let's say,
right,
for instance, you know, like I was telling you, go to Pittsburgh once a month and I work for this group called RWA, and I've got six or seven kids who go up there with me every month and work. And they have 200 and 250 of the most loyal fans every month. They're there, and they're going to boo, and they're going to cheer. If you give them something to respond to, if you just go out there and wrestle, they're going to fill in their hands and just not care. And you've got to, and so once you learn how to, if you can make 200 people get up out of their seats and cheer for you, or get 200 people up out of their seats and boo you and really want to see you lose, give me a crowd of 20,000. I can make them boo or cheer Lodi every single time. Because Pez taught me how to do that. There's a way to carry yourself. There's a way to react to everything that's going to get people to, just from some little mannerisms that'll get people to, oh, I like him, or people, oh, I just don't like that. And it's all about how you carry yourself. It's all the little stuff that another thing that young kids, if they don't have that experience, they're in the ring and they're so mindset or got their mind set on the next move and what's coming up, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K. They're thinking about the wrestling moves. They don't even get to be in the character.
Do you get a chance to watch a lot of the current products, WWE and TNA?
True story, yes. I try my best to watch Raw, although I'm an old man and it stays on past my bedtime, so I normally catch the first. I get home on Monday nights. I've got an in-home client. I get home about 9 or 9:30, and I'm usually in bed by 10, so I catch a little on Monday nights. I catch a little more on SmackDown because Friday night's my night off since I'm not wrestling, so I catch some of that. I've got several friends, you know, that work at Impact, and I try to watch their show, and I truthfully have a really hard time making it through a whole two-hour episode.
That seems to be common. You know, I talk to people. Do you watch Impact? In fact, I was just talking to somebody the other day. They said it gives me a headache. So
I literally try, and I love wrestling. I can even watch bad wrestling. But I just, it doesn't hold my interest. I just get bored with some of the stuff. And, you know, I love seeing, you know, Gunner being from North Carolina and watching him grow up as Phil Shatter here on and doing the Indies. And I still see him regularly on the weekends in North Carolina doing shows. I think the world of him. And I love seeing him do well. You know, and some of the other guys I like to watch. But it's just the storylines and some of the stuff they put out, it's just hard for me to follow. I just don't get it. And, it's frustrating because I think they, at maybe 6 months to a year ago, had a lot of talented guys there. And to see that much talent, I just don't understand how you can write a show that bad.
It takes some work.
It does. It's almost like you're trying to fail. I mean, you know, I've been lucky enough to work for Dusty Rhodes at his wrestling company and book for him, and he taught me a lot about booking wrestling shows. And I've had a lot of other guys bring me in and give them booking ideas and putting shows together or whatever. And, again, going back to the guys I spent time with, you know, Raven and Paige and those guys, and it's wrestling psychology. You don't have to make it rocket science. And you can actually sometimes dumb it down a little bit and make it really easy. And I just feel like sometimes I must overdo it in the whole speed rush through of everything. You know, boom, 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 boom. Instead of going from A to Z, let's say over the next couple of months, we'll go from A to Z in one single night. It's just too much.
I got a question here from your neck of the woods. Brian from South Carolina wants to know if WCW missed the boat with Goldberg.
I don't know if WWF missed the boat with Goldberg or WWE. I don't know if they missed the boat as much as he was just done with wrestling, to be honest with you. You know, I love playing this game with people, you know, especially young wrestling kids, but how many guys has Vince McMahon not created to be allowed to really get over at WWE?
True. Can't name very many.
Booker T,
yeah.
The Dudleys.
Well, the Diamond Dallas Page, he didn't create.
And, well, Page was there, what, a year?
Not very long.
I mean, and he was never a big star there. I mean, he was at the end of his career when he got there. I mean, he was at the end of his career when he started. Come on, give me a break. I love Page. But, you know,
that's true.
Come on, you know, it was, what was he, 43 when he won his first, you know, heavyweight strap
like
or
that.
Whatever. But one of the coolest things ever, we were in the locker room, and Page used to wear his tight jeans and black rock and roll shirts. I'll never forget, we're in a locker room somewhere, and I'm sitting with Kevin Nash, and Page walks in, and Nash says, Page, you can wear all the rock and roll t-shirts you want. You're still 50. And he was probably 45, 46 at the time. But it was just, you know, the whole locker room popped. It was just great because other guys were just so much younger then compared to Paige. But, you know, that's the thing. You look at it, how many guys he's allowed to get over that he didn't create. Few and far between. So I think they're in, and hey, it's his company. He can run it the way he wants. Look how much money the man makes. I love when wrestlers and fans really blast, you know, WWE for being wrong and doing things wrong with people, whatever. It's fine to criticize them, but they make a lot of money. They're doing something right.
How about WCW? You think they missed the boat with Goldberg, you know, when he was so hot?
They created it. I mean, you know, I know how many t-shirts he sold. I know how busy he was, and I know how much money he made. I don't think they could have made him any bigger. I think, you know, by, you know, changing his character when they turned him heel that time. I mean, there's some mistakes, yeah, but did they capitalize off him at the time when he was hot? Yeah, I think they did a great job with him.
I remember I was talking to Bobby Heenan, and I was talking about Goldberg, and he was like, you know, that streak he had, you know,
yeah.
They kept saying how many wins, and he said, if the fans make him win him another match, until they get tired of the streak, just continue pushing the streak.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, I suppose so, yeah. Until they get sick of it. Yeah, win another match. Who cares,
and,
right?
And, I mean, you know, here's another thing about and Bill was great to me. Bill trained out the power plant. He was there at the same time when I got started. He had been there maybe a month and a half longer right before I got there and went through the trial, made it at the power plant. So I was down there a lot with him when he was first learning to wrestle, and I took the jackhammer spear plenty of times to get that sucker right. but he was a great guy, and I had nothing but great things to say about him. I was happy for all the success he had, and you know, for all the things he had to do outside of the ring, you know, he was more than a trooper because, you know, WCW was riding him. I mean, a story that I've told over and over again, but we were on a house show loop through West Virginia. And one night we were in Charleston, the next night Huntington or something. And so I was early on the card for the second match. I already showered. And it was like 8:30, 9 o'clock. And I see Goldberg coming, you know, getting to the building. I've already showered and wrestled. I'm like, hey, superstar, nice to see you show up, you know. And he looked at me and he just stopped, you know. He was just getting to the building. He was in the main event or whatever. And he said, Lodi, he said, what did you do today? I said, well, you know, we finished the show last night. I got up. I went to the gym, drove to the next town, got here on time, worked my match, you know, why? Kind of bragging over what I'd done, you know. And he said, you know, I finished the match last night, and they flew me to Texas for an autograph signing. I flew from there to, like, South Bend, Indiana for another autograph signing. I just got here. Is that okay? And I'm like, keep on keeping on there, champ. Have at it, you know? I mean, he had literally been in two different states since the night before doing autograph signings to come in and then work. And I'm like, brother, you deserve your money. Go right ahead. And so that was his life, you know? And I tell people this, they look at me and they're like, oh, you're crazy. But I saw the physical toll it took on him to have that kind of schedule at times. And I don't know that I would have wanted that kind of success. I don't know if I could have handled it. It was hard enough for me to keep up with my schedule. You know, it really, you know, when you're on the road 20 to 25 days a month, that's tough, man. And that's what we were doing back then. And so, again, some people don't see that side of it. But when you're in airplanes and hotels and rental cars, and that's what you do, and you wrestle and you're in the gym and you're hard labor home, that's a tough life, man. It really is.
Yeah, I give you guys a lot of credit because I'm not a big traveler. And I always hated the suitcases, checking right. in, checking out, trying to find a decent place to eat, finding something decent to eat. That's
right.
That's difficult. I know when you go from city to city and you know the cities a little bit, you have some idea where to stay and where to eat. But when you're going to areas you've never been to before, it's like.
Right. I mean, it's tough. Like, but you're looking at, you know, like our deal was, you know, because, again, we're partying like rock stars, and we're up every morning to catch a flight out at 5:30 or 6 o'clock the next morning, and you got to get to the next town, you got to get to a gym, you got to get to the building. You know, again, I am thankful the good Lord blessed me with the ability to do that, and I think the world of all the guys that still do it have done it for a lifetime, but it is a harder life than just, for instance, you know, you turn on your TV at 8 o'clock and you see Lodi wrestle 8:30, a 10-minute match on Nitro, and you don't see me again until next week. Oh, you know, one match a week, how tough is that, Lodi? You don't see all the other stuff behind the scenes that really made it, you know, a tough life.
Looking back at your career, and one more wrestling question. Do you have any regrets? When you look back at your wrestling career, is there anything you wish you could change about your career?
I touched on this earlier, and obviously at this point in my life, being drug-free for several years, alcohol and drug-free totally for over 4.5 years now almost, I wish I could have made that whole run sober. I think I could have done a better job of taking care of myself, maybe being injured less, and maybe kept a job. You know, I don't necessarily blame the fact that I was a drug addict on me losing my job all the time, but I know a sober Lodi could have probably been a lot better than the one that you guys saw on TV every week. So if I have one regret, that's probably one I wish I could have taken away.
I don't want you to name any names or anything, right. But you were talking about, you know, the culture was partying at that WCW. How many people do you think really had a problem at that time?
Oh, a huge percentage.
I mean, more than half, you'd say?
Yeah. I mean, if you define a problem by what society would define a problem, 75% of the guys.
I mean addiction.
Yeah. It was over the top. I mean, I went to college. I partied like a rock star in college. I drank a lot. I was in the military. I mean, I saw guys who drank a lot. I was floored by what the guys, you know, when I went out with the WCW, the amounts and the drugs and the amounts of everything, it was just so excessive.
Now, I want to ask you a couple questions outside the wrestling ring, because I know you were a political science major and obviously a political junkie, so where do you think we are in terms of, you know, we got Obama, we've got Obamacare, we got the direction of the world now. Bigger debts, more spending, just kind of in general. I mean, where are we right now?
I don't want to be a naysayer or a foresayer of nothing but doom, but, you know, we've made some bad decisions in this country as far as our spending habits and spending problems. I'm not a big fan of a welfare society. I don't necessarily dislike President Obama. I think he and I have very different views on what our founding fathers thought when they runs the Constitution, and some of the things of what he believes in, I believe in, are just vastly different. I do tend to be a little more conservative and pretty much a Republican most of the time on most issues. And so the whole Obamacare thing itself, I think when you tout a program that's supposedly going to help 30 million uninsured people get insurance, but all it's done so far is to cause people to lose their insurance, It's not a health care for poor people. There's a lot more involved. It's a matter of growing the government and growing your political base. Disguised under the, we're going to get poor people health insurance. That's not necessarily the issue. And I think inevitably the cost it's going to have on our economy and the companies that got the 1 year buy to put off on having to to deal with this until next year. I think you will see a lot of people's hours cut back. And I think it could cause a very ugly economic recession when all of the things kick in within the next year that we're going to have to be faced with. I think there's going to be some changes somewhere. Unless I'm just crazy wrong, I don't see it being a good thing long term.
I don't know if I saw a poll. I don't remember which poll it was. Like the approval rating for Congress is like 6%.
It's terrible.
And yet when they're up for re-election, you're going to see all the incumbents win re-election again.
Can I put? I've got one thing that I think would solve a lot of our problems in D.C. And I throw this out every chance I get: term limits on our congressmen. We have term limits on our president. Put term limits on our congressmen, because here's our problem. Feel like when a congressman gets elected, they're full of vim and vigor and they want to change the world, and they get to D.C. and all of a sudden the power and everything that corrupts them, every single vote they make, it's no longer about what's best for my state, what's best for my constituents, or what's best for this country. It's what's going to keep me in office next time when I have to get voted in again.
And so not to mention they go from spend like $1 million to get $176,000 a year job, and then they leave Congress and they're worth millions of dollars. And you think,
exactly.
What happened there, huh?
Exactly. it's all about the money game. But if they were limited on their time, I think then they could vote more with their conscience and more what would be good for our country, as opposed to being tied to all the political groups that got them there, all the special interest groups that pay for their campaign, et cetera, whatever that they're tied to. If they're not getting reelected, but maybe one time, so they get two terms and they're out, then they could do what's best for our country as opposed to what's best for them and their pockets when they get back home. And that's one thing that drives me crazy, because the only people that can bring that up is Congress. Who's going to vote term limits on themselves?
And then they exempt themselves from all the laws they pass.
Exactly.
Like Obamacare.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that I think Rand Paul and Rubio have talked about throwing something out there where they can't, you know, put out a law that they don't have to abide by. I'm all for it. But again, I don't think that's ever going to pass, because you're asking, you know, hey, you got the fox in the in-house, you're telling the fox to get out. Fox is not going to leave. The fox has to tell himself to go.
That's right.
So that's kind of my take on the whole political thing. Like I said, I am a little conservative, and I'm not happy about this budget deal being passed with the issues it's causing for some of our veterans and some of our military people. Being former military myself, I feel like that is a very important part of our country, that, you know, these people who sacrificed life, limbs, you know, families, et cetera, whatever, and they're cutting back on some of their money, which I'm not a big fan of, because it's not like they're getting rich being in the military anyway, and we deserve, you know, to treat them a little better, I think.
What do you see for 2014? Do you see the Republicans kind of taking control of the House and Senate? Do you think they can repeal Obamacare?
I think they're going to hold to the House, and I'm thinking at this point they could possibly take over the Senate. Now, with a sitting Democratic president, not a lot they can get done. Again, not a lot he can get done. It'll be interesting to see what happens in 2016. I think the Republicans are going to have a tough time putting a ticket together that'll beat Hillary and anybody. That's not my choice to win the presidency in 2016. I just think it's going to come in. The Clinton machine's a tough one to beat, and I think the whole idea of having our first female president, I think that's going to be a tough one to beat. And that's just my take on it. And I've had Republican friends of mine who tell me I'm so wrong, and it's so wrong for me to say. But with my political science background and what I feel, I think unless somebody from the Republican Party really comes up with a really strong ticket to go against Hillary in 2016, I don't know that she can be beat. Now, if we get Condoleezza Rice to run, we might have a chance.
I agree with you. I mean, as bad as – I mean, we see the approval ratings for Obama in the toilet.
Right.
And yet, probably in 2016, you're probably right. Hillary is probably the favorite. And we've seen what the Republicans – I mean, John McCain is not really a Republican.
Right.
And he was – And Mitt Romney, you know, he passed Romney Care, which is almost the same thing as Obamacare. So you see there, I think that's where a lot of the frustrations lie. There doesn't seem like there's a lot of difference between the R's and the D's anymore.
Right. And, you know, again, the fun term for those guys are rhinos, Republicans in name only. McCain's the biggest rhino I've ever seen. And, you know, he didn't want to, you know, really bash Obama and kind of went in with kid gloves. I think somebody like Condoleezza Rice, although she said repeatedly she's not interested in running, that would be a great option, I think. But again, that's just a dream ticket. Maybe her and Alan West can run.
And lastly, we do appreciate your time, and I've had a lot of fun talking to you. I could probably talk to you for a couple hours, but I know you're a busy guy. Let us know what's going on with you. How can people get in contact with you? So shows you have coming up, and then obviously plug your social media out there.
Yeah, you know, my Twitter account, Lodi1Brad, Brad Lodi Kane on Facebook. There's a Lodi page, just L-O-D-I. Pretty easy to find if you look. There's a YouTube channel out there again, Lodi, the number one, Brad. Got all that stuff covered. And thank you for having me. And I try to say this to everybody, but I really do appreciate the fact that for 18 years, people have come out and paid money to watch me and boo me and cheer me. And I have lived a blessed life. And the good Lord has given me more than I could ever in a million years hope for. And you called earlier, we were first talking, and I said, you know, if I was doing any better, I'd be twins. I really have, you know, have lived a blessed and charmed life. And so if it ever sounds like I'm complaining about something, trust me, I've got a million more things to be happy about. So I do appreciate all the wrestling fans are out there take time to listen to this. And again, if you've ever been to one of my matches and boo, cheer, or care, I appreciate it. And my show's coming up in January. I'll have all the dates up on the Lodi page and on the Facebook and the Twitter here pretty soon. I'm booked January, February, and I'm already booking on March. And I've got a couple of companies I work for that I booked that all the way through December. So I look like next year is going to be just as busy, or if not busier than this past year. So everything is good on this end.
Lodi's in demand. That's great.
That is great. I'm thankful.
Well, maybe we'll have you back on at the elections in 2014. And you can handicap that for us.
That would be awesome. I would love to do that.
Great. Well, we do appreciate your time, and we wish you nothing but the best of luck.
All right. Thank you, man.